Welcome to SLP Nerdcast. I'm Kate.
And I'm Amy, and we appreciate you tuning in. In our podcast, we will review and provide commentary on resources, literature, and discussed issues related to the field of speech-language pathology.
You can use this podcast for ASHA professional development. For more information about us and certification maintenance hours, go to our website, www.slpnerdcast.com. SLP Nerdcast is brought to you in part by listeners like you. You can support our work by going to our website or social media pages and contributing. You can also find permanent products, notes, and other handouts, including a handout for this episode. Some items are free, others are not, but everything is always affordable. Visit our website, www.slpnerdcast.com, to submit a call for papers, to come on the show and present with us. Contact us anytime on Facebook, Instagram, or at info@slpnerdcast.com. We love hearing from our listeners, and we can't wait to learn what you have to teach us.
Just a quick disclaimer, the contents of this episode are not meant to replace clinical advice. SLP Nerdcast, its hosts, and its guests do not represent or endorse specific products or procedures mentioned during our episodes unless otherwise stated. We are not PhDs, but we do research our material. We do our best to provide a thorough review and fair representation of each topic that we tackle. That being said, it is always likely that there is an article we've missed or another perspective that isn't shared. If you have something to add to the conversation, please email us. We would love to hear from you.
Before we get started in today's episodes, financial and non-financial disclosures, I am the owner and founder of Grand Bois Therapy and Consulting, LLC, and co-founder of SLP Nerdcast. Amy Wonka is an employee of a public school system and co-founder of SLP Nerdcast. We're both members of ASHA SIG 12 and both serve on the AAC Advisory Group for Massachusetts Advocates for Children. I am a member of the Berkshire Association for Behavior Analysis and Therapy, MassABA, the Association for Behavior Analysis International, and the corresponding Speech-Language Pathology and Applied Behavior Analysis Special Interest Group. I'm not going to say huzzah. It's so hard. I am in such a habit of saying either hooray or huzzah after we do that little intro, for those of you who may be new to the podcast, and someone made fun of me, Amy, and I'm not going to say it anymore. So today's episode is the second part of AAC Basics. Yes. For those of you who are just joining us, our first episode on AAC Basics was related to terminology and personnel. And today we are going to discuss barriers to AAC knowledge and implementation, as well as strategies to overcome those barriers. We chose this topic because as two working AAC specialists, we feel pretty strongly that speech and language pathologists should be empowered to have the knowledge, to treat clients with AAC and should be empowered with the competence to do so. We have structured today's episode a little bit differently than our previous episodes. Our learning objectives today are identify barriers for successful implementation across different environments and identify successful strategies across different environments and profiles. So instead of going through those two learning objectives one by one, we are going to discuss the different roles that are within AAC implementation. We'll define what those roles are pretty briefly. And we are going to identify barriers within each of those roles and then discuss strategies to overcome those barriers within each of those roles. So instead of going through our learning objectives, boom, boom, one, two, we're going to sort of discuss barriers and strategies collectively together as we discuss the episode. Yes?
Huzzah.
Thanks. That makes me feel better.
I know.
So Amy, do you want to kick us off to give a little bit of background in terms of what the AAC roles are?
Sure. In our earlier episode, we discussed the idea that, you know, AAC is something that in most environments is owned by many, many people. And that includes the person with complex communication needs. And then lots of other people who interact with that person. But each person who's involved has sort of different roles and responsibilities. And sometimes what happens is we'll see, you know, folks kind of back away from any role or responsibility in the context of AAC because they feel like they maybe don't know enough or it's not their role. And so part of what we're going to talk about right now is just a bit about those different roles and how it is really important that everybody sort of plays their part in the implementation of AAC. So as we know, people with complex communication needs who use augmentative and alternative communication are a really heterogeneous group. So you can't, you know, if you've met one person who uses AAC, you've met one person who uses AAC.
That's such a good expression. I've heard it used with autism before, but not AAC, and I think it's perfect.
I think it's applicable, you know, across all domains. In particular, there's a lot of heterogeneity when we think about people with complex communication needs who use AAC, and that can be uncomfortable for communication partners because you can't really say, well, then you do this. If the person checks XYZ boxes, then this is your prescription for what you're supposed to do. So that level of ambiguity and breadth can be hard for communication partners. So we're going to reference the work of Kathy Binger et al. And this article is up on our website. They introduced a personnel framework to help clarify professional roles within the context of an AAC assessment process. In reading this article, I feel like these roles are also helpful to think about in terms of implementation.
And for those of you who listened to our first episode, we did go through this article in the first episode, and we're just going to do a review for the context of discussing barriers and strategies within each of these roles as defined in that article.
Correct. And we're only actually going to talk about a few of the roles from that article because what we're focusing on today is clinical problem solving, identifying barriers, and then thinking about some solutions around those barriers. So we're going to sort of use these personnel roles as a way to think about those different barriers in different environments. So there are a number of roles described in the article that we're not covering today. So the first role that we're going to start with, I'm going to back up for a second. As we go through these roles, I want you as a listener to try and figure out which of these hats you wear, because chances are you wear at least one of them. So perhaps multiple. So listen and try and place yourself as we go through these roles. Okay, the first one is the AAC finder. And to quote Binger et al., the primary and essential roles of the AAC finder are to identify individuals who might benefit from AAC and make referrals to professionals with AAC assessment expertise. AAC finders may include an array of individuals, including the person with complex communication needs, their family members, their friends or peers, medical personnel, and educational personnel. So they make the point that a lot of these finders don't make the referral, and that has really negative implications for the people who use AAC, right? So when you're referred late for your AAC assessment, that's deferred time before you get access to an AAC system that can help you, and that's learning time lost and probably a greater number of frustrating experiences. They make another couple of other points, just that a lot of these finders may not have training or instruction in the area of AAC. So when we move forward in the barriers, we'll talk a little bit more about that. So in our next role, and this is a big important role, this is the general practice SLP. So in their article, they describe the role of many SLPs working with people who use AAC as people who are providing a range of services, but they're not specialists in AAC. So their definition for general practice SLPs would be these professionals provide direct service speech language services and include SLPs who, working in schools, hospitals, private practices, and long-term care facilities, often serve as the primary SLPs for individuals who use AAC. Currently, it's common for general practice SLPs to serve as AAC finders, making those referrals. Okay, so there are a lot of general practice SLPs. I would say for myself, I am no longer a general practice SLP. These are the people, like, to make this analogy to healthcare, I think of the general practice SLP as like my general practitioner physician. So that's the person I go to if I have a problem and I'm like, oh, I have this problem, I've got a sore throat, I'm going to go to my doctor. For a lot of things, my doctor is able to just take care of those things for me. But if it's something else that requires specialized support and help, like I've got a funny mole or something, you know, she's going to send me to the dermatologist who is somebody who is just like, you know, an expert in all things skin related. And that's who you want to go see for your funny mole.
So in our field, a general practice SLP, this article was the first time I had heard this term. And it made me feel better because I also no longer feel like a general practice SLP and I can't treat. I used to be able to have, you know, I used to have knowledge about fluency and dysphagia. I'm probably saying it wrong. I don't even know how to say it. That's how little I know about updated information because I've been doing nothing but AAC for so long. And I think, you know, the general practice SLP plays such a massive role in AAC intervention. And we'll talk about that more as we go through and identify barriers and strategies. But the general practice SLP is just the most important, one of the most important players. There are many important players, but I guess my point is that in this article, I really appreciated that they called out and gave a whole bucket to the general practice SLP. I really appreciated them.
Well, and I think similar to the general practitioner, you know, in my Jazzy Mole example, you know, I don't want to go to the dermatologist for my strep throat, right? So the general practice SLP serves such an important function, and they have so many tools.
The people at home listening, oh, who are these people and their body parts? Go on.
Dermatologists are our friends and they help us wear something.
It's true.
I feel as though when we think about general practice SLPs, they have all of this knowledge about a broad range of client needs. And so they're also a huge resource. If you're not the general practice SLP, the general practice SLP is a huge and important resource. If you are the general practice SLP, well, thank you, because you're a huge and important resource. And you know, you have a lot of knowledge and skills, but within that is a responsibility for people who use AAC if they're on your caseload. The next role that we'll talk about is the AAC clinical specialist. This is sort of the role that Kate and I are both currently employed in. These are professionals typically who are SLPs who have particular expertise in AAC, are skilled at conducting AAC assessments, and take a leading role in securing funding for SGDs. They are referred to as AAC intervention specialists in the article 2008 by Buchelman et al. And they're described as professionals who typically spend at least 50% of their working day on AAC-related activities. So compared with general practice SLPs, people who are in this sort of clinical specialist role are receiving, you know, lots of professional development. They're digging deep on all of these topics, reading the research, going to conferences, doing all of these things really specific to AAC. So people in the AAC clinical specialist role have a lot of information about a narrow range of content. And so the intersection between somebody who's a clinical specialist and somebody who's a generalist really provides this amazing, robust continuum of information for the client with complex communication needs.
Totally agreed. And I'm not sure if we mentioned this in a previous episode, but the AAC clinical specialist is somebody who, if you are a general practice SLP seeking more information about AAC, AAC implementation, or you're clinically interested in moving into an AAC clinical specialist role at some point in your career, we might talk about this a little bit more later, but mentorship is one of the most amazing experiences I've ever had. My mentor was this lady named Amy. I don't know if anybody has ever heard of her. She's sitting across from me. I can see her face. But this is, and I'm very passionate about mentorship, and I know Amy can talk about her mentorship experience and mentoring experience. If you do have an interest in moving more into a specialist role or really embracing AAC as part of your practice, I cannot say enough about what a great learning experience that can be. And Asha has tons to say about mentoring. It's documented well in the literature. We're going to do an episode on it more in the future. But anyway, soapbox over. Moving on.
No, I agree with that sentiment. I mean, I say all the time that all of my best ideas were somebody else's idea that I just 100%. Sort of absorbed. put inside a file folder somewhere in my brain. And I do think, you know, that's probably true for most of us with any of our clinical skills. We learn those skills through interacting with our clients and with other clinicians. So to work with somebody who has a focused interest and study in one area is a wonderful way to learn more. One more thing about this AAC clinical specialist, you don't have to have that job title. That is more a category that they're using to describe somebody who is predominantly involved in AAC activities as the bulk of their clinical practice. It doesn't need to be what you're called. And the structure of AAC teams is going to vary a lot depending on where you're located and what type of work environment that you're in. So just to know, these are categories that are not specific job titles. They're just descriptions of the type of work that these different people are doing and sort of what their roles are within the AAC assessment process.
So next on the list, AAC clinical specialist is the AAC facilitator and communication partner. What can you tell us about that role?
So these folks are super important, and they are, the authors make the distinction between the two roles. And so I'm, again, just going to pull words from their article. They say that the role of facilitator, broadly speaking, is to assist with the client's day-to-day AAC needs, which may include device maintenance, like charging and programming, interacting with manufacturers, and providing instruction for communication partners. So AAC facilitators can include family members, friends, general practice SLPs, AAC clinical specialists, lots and lots of different people. So they sort of separate out the operational tasks, is how I read this. Like, so the operational tasks of like maintaining and dealing with the actual, you know, aided tool, and then communication partners, they're describing as folks who typically have relationships with clients using AAC that are either social, like family members and friends, or educational and caring in nature. So like teachers, PCAs. These people who are in the partner role are assisting the communication exchange at a level that is typically not expected of a less involved listener. So partners are working together. They're doing some co-construction of messages. They're resolving communication breakdowns. So a communication partner is different from a facilitator in terms of the jobs that that person is doing. Facilitator's troubleshooting all of these equipment things. The communication partner is having this relational experience with the person who's using AAC. And they're doing that in a way that's different from somebody in the general public. So they're making the distinction, you know, between a communication partner who has a more active role in the interaction compared with somebody who's not communicating with the AAC user at that same level.
Okay, that seems pretty succinct.
And then, I think that, you know, another important point to raise there is just that a lot of the people are in both of those roles together, right? So there's a lot, you know, you are very likely to be multiple roles that we've already talked about.
Right. The last identified role per this article is collaborating professionals. And as Amy already mentioned, you know, depending on your work environment, depending on a variety of things, the team of individuals working with the client is really going to vary. And there are so many collaborating professionals that should have input and participate in any assessment or implementation. We're not really talking about assessment today, but any component where AAC is involved. And that could include teachers, paraprofessionals, occupational therapists, physical therapists, BCBAs. You know, these individuals are really going to, like I said, they're going to need information about AAC, but they're also going to have input based on what stage you are in the AAC process.
Precisely.
Precisely.
So we're going to cut that out, right?
Totally not. Nope, that stays. Sorry, Aim. Moving on. So are those all of our defined roles?
Yes. Those are not all of the roles that are defined in the Binger et al. Article, but those are all of the roles that we're going to talk about moving forward.
Okay. So now that we have a little bit of background, or we've reviewed the roles, we are going to, instead of moving through with our two separate learning objectives, we are going to discuss each of these roles, barriers for each of those roles, and then strategies to overcome each of those roles. So we assume that the bulk of our audience are SLPs. That may not be the case. If you are an SLP, I think learning about the barriers and challenges for each of these separate roles is still really clinically important because it's information that you can give to the AAC facilitator. It's information you can or identify with a collaborating professional to facilitate improved relationships or interactions with AAC. You can facilitate improved AAC implementation in the different settings. So I do think that understanding barriers and strategies for each of these separate roles is very important.
I would agree. And I think
I love it when you agree with me. It makes me have all the I feel very validated.
It is nice. So I think that part of what will come out of these ongoing conversations is the helpfulness of clarity of roles. So you don't need to go to your team members and say, you are a finder and you are the AAC clinical specialist. I am the generalist SLP. It's not really about assigning roles. It's more about thinking of the different tasks that are involved in supporting somebody who is learning to use augmentative communication. And then making sure that everybody who should be responsible for a portion of those roles understands that they should be responsible, agrees that they should be responsible, and that everybody's on board with their different place in the process.
I totally agree. And I think if anything, delineating specific roles or titles can be more divisive than helpful, and it creates a barrier. I know Amy and I have both experienced this as the quote AAC specialist. That's our job titles. That's what we're hired to do. And if you, you know, go into a setting where you don't have relationships with the employees there, or you're new on the scene, there can be this barrier of, well, this lady came in and, or this man, you know, there's an AAC specialist who's a man out there, I'm sure you're out there, hello. You know, coming in being like, oh, this lady thinks she knows everything. I think giving titles to these team members can be, can really sort of instigate territorialism and egoism, which are absolute barriers across the board to almost everything. So, I think if you think of in thinking about these roles quietly in your mind and then thinking about the tasks that the AAC user needs to accomplish with each of these different individuals is the more collaborative and facilitates more work being done in a positive way.
That's such a good segue into our first barrier.
Excellent. Which is look at that. Delayed. I did that. It was magic. I didn't even plan it.
Delayed or missed referrals. So this is happening if your finders aren't finding. But no, you don't want to go to your finders and say, you're a finder.
Why did you find? What a terrible finder, you bad.
Terrible finder. Did you even know that you're the finder? Right. So I mean, you can see how that could pose some problems that you don't want to create for yourself. But I think that this is actually something that occurs relatively frequently. In the Binger et al. Article, they actually talk about, they cite some other studies, you know, just giving examples about delayed access. They had a study they cited where late referral by finders was cited as a problem in 93% of individuals with ALS who were eventually referred to an AAC assessment. And they found similar delays in a different study, similar delays in referral observed in a study of children with cerebral palsy. So again, these are people who aren't getting access to the supports that they need in a timely manner. So finders not finding is a problem. It's a barrier for the people who have complex communication needs.
And so just as a reminder, the finder, I guess for me, the first thing that comes to mind is a parent or a communication partner. That's not always the case. It could be a teacher. It could be the gym teacher. It could be, you know, another specialist on the team. It could be the general practice SLP or the primary SLP. The difference is that primary SLPs, general practice SLPs, we have knowledge of AAC. We went to school. Most of us had a class on it. We are aware that it exists. And the majority of finders might not have that information. They might have seen an episode on 60 Minutes about ProLoquo to Go in 2011 or whenever that aired, you know, and they might have some knowledge, but they don't necessarily have the deeper knowledge for that AAC could be used for augmenting speech. It could be used for people with limited speech. It doesn't necessarily have to be a more emergent communicator who has zero functional speech. So, and I guess I'm so good with segues today. That's a good segue into the solution for delayed referral. Take it away, Amy.
Well, you make great points, right? I think identifying that really depending on your environment, and I would say in the work environments, in all of the work environments where I've been employed, you kind of want everybody to be a potential finder. You want anybody to be a potential finder. And most of those people did not go to school for speech language pathology. So one of the important solutions is just to give people access to that information and to give them access to information about AAC in a way that is easily digestible, not overwhelming, but just something they can put in the back of their brain and remember. And I think that's information about what AAC is in general, but it's also information about the process and procedure in your own particular work environment. So what do you do if you think somebody might benefit from AAC?
You had mentioned to me previously some good ideas about, again, all my best ideas are someone else's ideas. This is one that you said, not me. But distributing permanent product or handouts, like pamphlets, putting flyers up in your school setting or in your clinic. A lot of places have bulletin boards, like, did you know, with like graphics or pictures or something that's easily digestible, just to get the information out there so that someone in your work setting just walking by sees the reminder that AAC is a thing and it's not just for, X profile person. Another thing that Amy and I had talked about a while ago, and this is more at a much larger institutional level, but here in Massachusetts, we have, in order to get your teacher licensure, you have to have a certain number of hours. I can't remember what the exact specification is, but 10. You need,
huh? 10.
You need it's to 10. Have 10 hours? Yeah. I should know that. For a variety of reasons. But anyway, so teachers, in order to get a teacher licensure, have to have 10 hours of either, is it observation or continuing education? I think a variety of activities participate. Point being, by the time they become teachers and they're in the classroom, they know a little bit about what AAC is. So depending on where you are in your country, if you have access to, lobbyists or, feel like writing your congressman or woman, your state representative, that is something that I feel has been really helpful in our geographical area to get information to the finders who are teachers.
Yeah, I agree with that, Kate. I think that what it does is it's kind of set the stage for a whole new group of finders to have basic information about what AAC is and who could benefit. And I think when you're providing information to finders or people who are potential finders, it can also be helpful just to remind people that, AAC doesn't reduce somebody's likelihood of developing or using oral speech. It's not an either or. And I think that this comes back to people who would benefit from augmenting their communication. I think sometimes when I've experienced later referrals, it is often complex communicators who would fall into that category of being somebody who it could really help to augment their communication. And sometimes what happens too is if you're somebody who might use it to augment your communication in different environments, and we'll talk a lot more about this a little bit later in the podcast, just considering different environments and tasks. But when you have very familiar communication partners who understand your oral speech, they might not identify that it is a potential barrier for you moving into a broader environment or with more communication partners. So that's also something that generalist SLPs or AAC clinical specialists can help to make sure that finders better understand that communication efficacy is really a bigger thing than just in this one moment at this one time. And we need to kind of think about supporting our communicators across their entire life and their communication needs across the day.
I agree completely. Is that a reasonable segue into our second bucket?
Why, yes, I believe it is.
Second barrier. So the second barrier that is related to the next role is having unclear roles. So someone saying it's not my job or AAC is something that someone else does.
Yeah. And I feel like, Kate, you touched on this a little bit. I don't love the term specialist. I don't love the idea of pulling out a whole section of SLPs as being specialists.
Yes, we are not going to open Pandora's box and discuss the SLP certification for AAC specialties, AAC specialty certification. But
yeah,
I suppose as a current events news announcement to anyone who is listening, the AAC specialty certification is going to be a thing. It takes a while. It will be a couple of years. People have strong feelings about it. We are not going to discuss those strong feelings, but it is happening. So I suppose stay on the lookout for news related to that. But in terms of how that relates to this barrier, so we in discussing that, you know, the one of the barriers is people thinking that AAC is something that someone else does and it's not their responsibility. That barrier can go in reverse in terms of someone thinking, well, I'm the one that does the AAC and no one else does it. So effective AAC implementation really does need to be a two-way street, but, you know, a collaborative effort where it's a shared responsibility and the AAC quote specialist, quote certified specialist, whoever, is empowering everyone on the team to take ownership of and embrace the tool.
Yes, I say the opposite of huzzah to that.
What is the opposite of
I don't know.
Poo-poo?
I don't know.
That could be it.
No, that it's not nearly as fun of a word.
Poo-poo?
Poo-poo?
Okay. We'll think of it. If anyone has any ideas of what the opposite of huzzah is, we would love to hear from you.
Yes. Yes, we would. But no, I mean, I think right. There shouldn't be, whether you are a certified specialist or not, there shouldn't be one person driving the AAC bus. And if there is one person, you're probably not driving the right bus. So in reading to prepare for this podcast, we came across an article from Hunt et al., and we will post this up on our website as well. It is titled Collaborative Teaming to Support Students with Augmentative and Alternative Communication Needs in General Education Classrooms. I thought this article was awesome. They have a lot of it's definitely worth checking out, especially if you work in a school or other team-based environment. They define collaborative teaming as a group of individuals with diverse experience working together to achieve mutually defined goals. And according to experts in the field of collaborative teaming, an effective collaborative teaming process involves regular, positive, face-to-face interactions, a structure for addressing issues, performance and monitoring, and clear individual accountability for agreed upon responsibilities. So
I love that quote.
Yeah, it this is great. And I think it connects. I think this article resonated a lot with me because it connects to a lot of what I do in my work with implementation plans and using the SET framework, which are both strategies for collaborative team-based approaches to AAC.
And I think it extends beyond AAC in general. I mean, you know, you could apply this amazing quote that maybe we will put on our website with a reference to any team collaboration, especially where you might have some prickly pears.
Yeah. I mean, this article was great. They make the point that, you know, you have a lot of different team members. Those team members can have overlapping functions. So sort of back to the Binger article where we talk about the different roles, a lot of people who are participating in AAC supports have a lot of different roles. They have a lot of different functions, and all of those people are important. All of those roles are important. And when we think about working collaboratively with other people, in this Hunt paper, they reference an earlier study by Soto and colleagues in 2001, where they, you know, go through some interviews with people who have worked on collaborative teams for at least 3 years. And, you know, people really felt like, so you can't really do that without collaborative teaming. It's really necessary in order to have successful inclusion. So collaborative teaming, when we think back to that definition we just said, that involves a lot of components, it involves a lot of time, it involves a lot of parts. Training was another thing that came up as important in that Soto article. And then finally, they felt that the regular team meetings with all members contributing toward achieving shared and mutually defined goals was reported to be very important. So back to...
I love that. shared and mutually defined goals. And I think that is so important, especially if you are employed or acting as an AAC specialist. And this will be incredibly important for any quote certified people in the future. You do not own it. You don't own it. It doesn't belong to you. Your job is to take the input from other people and collaborate and not show up on the scene and tell everybody what to do. It's not how it works. Just a little bit passionate about that. I will step off my soapbox again.
Yes. So we're not going to get deep into it today in this podcast, but I would point you, if you're interested in learning more about collaborative teaming, if you're interested in learning more about implementation plans, we have a podcast for both of those. So I would encourage you to check those out. The last thing that I want to talk about with the Hunt et al. Paper, and the reason why you should look this paper up and you should print it out, is their idea of a unified plan of support, or a UPS. So this, to me, is essentially a version of what I'm doing when I do implementation plans. It's basically, it's a documentation that looks at the curriculum, the communication, and the social supports. So when I was reading it, it's like an implementation plan for assistive technology and an implementation plan for augmentative communication, like integrated in together, because this article was about inclusion. So using AAC in an inclusion setting in general education. What's awesome about this paper and why you should print it out is that they have examples. So you can look in the paper and they print examples of what this actually looks like. So it can really help you if you're somebody who's in a generalist SLP position or you're the AAC clinical specialist. If you take a look at this paper, you can get a feel for examples of what their UPS looked like. And that might help you shape some of your own. I would say, you know, start small, don't try and write this big, huge document for everybody. But really consider if this is something that you can use in your practice. And again, that's probably most applicable when we think back to those roles for people who are either in a generalist or an AAC specialist position. I love these articles.
These are such good finds.
No, they're so good. So, you know, if you listen to this podcast, you know, there's like typically one or two articles that we're like, oh man, you should really print this out. This is one of them because you want to see their example. And I thought the one for people who are in an AAC clinical specialist role and are already doing implementation plans, something that was super cool in this article that I want to find a way to integrate into my work is that the authors use a rating scale. For each of the items on their implementation plan, essentially, they use a rating scale so that when the team meets monthly, they go through each section of the implementation plan and determine as a group how much success they had implementing these different things. And their metrics were, you know, not at all, somewhat, moderately well, and fully. And so what they found was that by assigning these ratings together as a group and going through each area of the implementation plan and determining their ratings as a group, it allowed them to emphasize strategies that they rated as somewhat, right? So perhaps for AAC, it might be modeling. Maybe it's modeling during shared storybook reading and people are like, we're doing that somewhat. Then they decide as a group, like, okay, we're really going to emphasize this for the next month. And then they can revise and eliminate strategies that the group scored as not at all implemented, right? So they might say, oh, shared, you know, modeling during shared reading, we're not implementing that at all because we find that, you know, it's not necessary and it's cumbersome and the student is engaged and doing fine with the supports that are in place for everybody else in the classroom. So we're not doing this too much. So then they just pull that off the plan. So it's clear to everybody what their goals are. This is a great article.
So this is basic, just to sort of wrap that back into our learning objectives. Having a written implementation plan, having some of these metrics is a great strategy for overcoming the barrier of team collaboration, getting other people involved, a classroom teacher or another professional who thinks that it's not really their responsibility. This is something that happens only in the speech room, down the hall, or only in the outpatient clinic. And having some of these meetings and some of these strategies, not only are they evidence-based right here in the literature, but they're effective.
Yes. And so for the barrier of it's not my job or it's somebody else's job, the solution for that is to have a clear and ideally written down and discussed on an ongoing basis guideline for whose job it is and what the expectation is.
And this barrier of it's not my job, AAC is something that someone else does, is related to several roles identified in that original, that first article, right? So I can imagine that it would be relevant possibly to the AAC finder if they're still in the picture. It would be relevant still to probably not the general practice SLP or the AAC clinical specialist, but the AAC facilitators, that's a really mm-hmm. wide role, the communication partners, and the collaborating professionals. Right. So based on that first article from Binger, the Binger et al. Article, there is such a wide variety of roles, and having better more effective collaboration to decrease the feelings that it's not their responsibility is really, really important.
For sure. And for barrier number three, you might be the general practice SLP who up until this point has thought, it's not my job. We have somebody in my office who has specialist after their name. Pretty sure it's their job, not my job.
Or you are maybe a new grad, or maybe you're not a new grad, but this is your first experience with SLP, and secretly and quietly in your thinking bubble, you're going, I'm going to fake it till I make it, which is okay. Everybody starts somewhere. And if you don't know where to start, or you're just on, you know, in the beginning of your journey, or maybe you're a classroom teacher who is also having those same mm-hmm. feelings, it's okay. But there are things that you can do to facilitate your knowledge.
Right. So barrier number three, I don't know where to start, right? That's your barrier. I can't even get started. This is completely overwhelming. It's not a matter of organizational, you know, delineating roles. I don't even know what the roles are. I don't know what we're supposed to be doing, right?
And to be fair, I've been working as an AAC quote specialist, but basically be doing nothing but AAC in my practice since I was for 8 or 9 years. And my first technology conference, my first AAC conference, I literally walked through the vendor hall and was like, I'm not using that. I'm never going to use that. That looks stupid. I was totally intimidated. It's what happens. It is a natural part of the learning process. Accept it. Move on. It's gonna be okay.
We're gonna take you into our time machine now, and we're gonna bring you back to 1989. In 1989, a speech language pathologist named Janice Light wrote a paper where she defined communicative competence for AAC users as the development and integration of skills from 4 different domains. And those domains are operational competence, linguistic competence, social competence, and strategic competence.
Are you bringing up this article because this is where people should start?
Yes.
So this is like the basic fundamental start here. This is the strategy for overcoming that barrier.
Yes. So this is the foundation. I'm actually going to direct people to a 2014 article that she wrote, she co-wrote with David McNaughton. This will be on our website. And I was actually, sometimes these articles, you know, you're only able to get access to them if you're an ASHA member, or you're only able to get access to them if you're, you know, in school actively and have access to, you know, an online database. This one I was able to find for free online. It's a really great article, but it's a response to her work in 1989. And then in 2003, she expanded that initial idea to include psychosocial factors like motivation, attitude, confidence, and resilience, as well as barriers and supports within a communicator's environments, is all of these things that come together to result in communicative competence for people who have complex communication needs and are utilizing AAC. So I'm so fortunate to have this wonderful job where I'm able to dig really deep in this one topic area and learn so, so much about this clinical area that's so interesting and meaningful for me. And even with that, I don't know all the things, right? So I have this privilege to be able to learn all of these things. I still don't know everything. I'm learning new things all the time. And so when you step back and think back to those roles, if you're a finder or a partner or a general practice SLP, how overwhelming must it feel? Because AAC is big. It's not just learning how to use the system and navigate the system. It's not just learning the receptive and expressive language skills. It really is the integration of all of these components. So if you're feeling like you don't know where to start, please print out this 2014 Janice Light and David McNaughton article. And we're going to talk, we'll talk you through the highlights of it, but it's really good. And it kind of covers all of these big areas.
We will have a, we will have it on our website as a reference. Is it possible because it's free? Can we put a link?
That's a good question for you because you're the webmaster. Can we put a link? I don't know.
No, but I mean, it's not a violation of any copyright if we put a link so people can click on it and just get the article.
No, I mean, I guess if they stopped letting it be free, the link would be dead. And then hopefully someone would email us, let us know, and we would take it down.
We will figure this out, people. We will have an easy way for you to get this article off of our website.
That's right.
Stay tuned. Check
that. That's right. So in this 2014 article, which is just super good, you know, the authors are reflecting back on their work from 25 years ago, right? So they're looking back on this 1989 article, and making the point that in that time, so many things have changed for people who use AAC, right? So 25 years ago, a lot of the people who are using AAC are living in these large residential institutions. They have very limited educational and vocational opportunities. Now, thankfully, folks with complex communication needs are doing all sorts of amazing, you know, people are going to work, they're going to school, they're participating in their communities to a greater degree. And what's happened is those changes have also resulted in increased communication demands that really we do need to address. We need to think about all these things. As clinicians who are supporting people who are using AAC, we need to think about the now, we need to think about the future, and we need to think about how all of these different components intersect. And if that feels overwhelming, I think it's because it is, but this article really helps walk you through and kind of compartmentalize all the different things that you want to be thinking about. So we're going to go through the four core key areas from Dr. Light's 1989 article, and we're going to start with those because those are a really helpful starting point.
So just to review, those four areas are linguistic, operational, social, and strategic.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Take it away.
And we're going to start with linguistic. So linguistic, I think, is one of the pieces that feels most comfortable to those of us who are the generalist SLPs, because this is getting at a lot of the training that we've received that is not connected with AAC, right? So this is receptive language skills. This is expressive language skills, semantics, syntax, all of these things. So it's complicated by the fact that many aided AAC systems aren't necessarily true language systems, right? So they may not have inherent syntax, they might not have morphology or grammar. So part of what you need to tease out is thinking about what your client who has complex communication needs is working on in terms of their expressive and receptive language skills. So if you know, regardless of your setting, you're probably doing assessments. So if you've done a formal or informal language assessment, look at where that communicator is currently. If there is some, you know, you may see a gap between expressive and receptive language skills. You may not. You may see expressive and receptive language skills that are clustering kind of the same. And use your clinical decision making just like you would if you weren't factoring in AAC into your clinical decision making to make choices about what's an appropriate next step. If your person is primarily a single word communicator, you know, think about things like Brown stages. Think about, you know, acquiring around 50 single words before you're working on two word combinations. Once you're doing some two word combinations, also think about the early morphology like present progressive and things that we tend to see around that same language acquisition phase. Think about having a balanced corpus of types of vocabulary that you're using. You'll hear a lot corpus. About
such a big word, a balanced corpus.
It's fun though. It's a fun word.
It is a fun word, but a balanced word bank, a balanced body.
Right. So a balanced body, and that's important because when we think about linguistic skills, we don't want our communicator just to be using nouns. And we talked about this a little bit in the first chunk of this podcast, the part one. But sometimes that's a trick that we get tricked by with aided AAC, because a lot of types of words are not good picture producers, right? So sometimes we have a tendency to do nouns, nouns, nouns. But when we look at just good language intervention, good expressive language intervention, it's not all nouns. And so just being mindful of those components. So those would all fall into this linguistic skills bucket.
For me, the takeaway, very general takeaway from this linguistic, the article of this linguistic category is that as an SLP, you don't need, you're not using totally different skills. You're still using your SLP skills. You're still yes. making decisions about language. It's almost not different at all. You just have this extra tool. It's like learning to go from writing with a pen to typing. It's still language. It's still, right. you know, a lot of it is still the same. You just have this extra thing that you have to take into consideration.
And I think with that, taking into consideration other components of language, exclusive, like separate from the thing. So we talked in the first phase of this podcast about aided versus unaided. Well, if you have somebody who's learning to use single word symbolic communication, you're probably also working on unaided methods using gestures, just like you would, just like typical language intervention for anybody who is working on that, you know, 1 to 2 word level. I think another big piece to consider in this linguistic competence bucket is it's not just expressive. And I think that's another place where we get a little tricked sometimes as clinicians, because we're so focused on AAC, we're so focused on the expressive component. Remember to step back a little bit and do a thorough inventory of your client's current skills and their gap areas. So if you have somebody who has receptive language skills that are, you know, within normal limits and are not a concern, and not, are not a limiting factor for them in any way, then yes, go super hard and heavy on the expressive component. But if you step back and, you know, you find that there are still receptive gaps, even if those gaps are syntax morphology gaps, make sure that you're working on those still receptively. We don't necessarily, again, we know that AAC users are a very heterogeneous group. So just because you acquire a skill expressively doesn't necessarily mean that's going to transfer to a receptive skill. And we need to make sure that we have equal emphasis if that's what the person's needs warrant. So just in the linguistic bucket, think about typical language development acquisition.
All the skills you already have. Yep.
Yep.
All the skills you already have as an SLP, all the training you already did.
Yep. Don't forget about morphology and don't forget about receptive skills and making judgments about the person's linguistic skills as a whole.
Very well summarized. Operational. The operational competency.
This is where it gets a little scary for people, I think, a little bit. I think when I first started, this is what was scary for me. I did start in the advent, like before iPads and all of those things. I was working in AAC before that. And so I, like some of the things that I knew about my clients' AAC devices were that they were very expensive and I did not want to do anything to break them. I did not want to be the person to break the device. So I think that operational skills are where it can get scary for people. When I first started with AAC, it was before iPads. It was before, you know, cell phone. I don't think I had a cell phone. But it was before, you know, this kind of consumer electronics was ubiquitous. And so what I knew was that my clients' devices were very expensive, very complicated, and I did not want to be the person who broke them.
Right. And they were huge. They were clunky. Every operating system had a different system. I mean, there wasn't uniform. It's very different now. I always think of operational competencies as the technical, non-linguistic, how you use it, how you charge it, how you program it, what the AAC user's independence is across those things. Do they carry it from place to place? It's the unfun, non-communicative nuts and bolts.
I think, yes, you
generally
speaking, captured
it. I mean, this article does a very good job of describing this in a much more science-rooted language, but generally speaking, the takeaway is that it's important to make sure that you're focusing not only on the linguistic components of AAC and those linguistic AAC skills, but also the ownership and maintenance and techie nuts and bolts kind of stuff.
Yes. And I think these are the pieces that can be intimidating for people who maybe don't have a huge comfort level with electronics. And even though, you know, the dynamic is a little bit different now, I think you still know that this is important. You don't want to mess it up. And I'm thinking of people particularly who are in that facilitator and partner role. You might not know as much about the tool. You might not know or feel as comfortable navigating it or doing basic programming, kind of those finder tasks, or excuse me, the facilitator tasks. And I think it's important for people to get some level of comfort. And there's a lot of different ways to do that. A lot of the manufacturers have trainings and different resources online. You can also check in with your, you know, look at your implementation plan, see if your generalist SLP or your AAC clinical specialist can help you out with this.
This is also a great thing to do. We have previously encouraged people to attend a handful of conferences to get additional information, ATIA, Closing the Gap, ISAC, mm-hmm. which is ISAAC. Mm-hmm. It's an international conference. The vendor halls, take an hour or two and cruise the vendor halls and play with the stuff. Get your hands dirty. Ask the vendors information. That's a really, and I mean, this field changes every year. Every, you know, handful of years, I don't go to one of these conferences. I feel like I'm a fraud because the technology has changed so much and the software has changed so much and the light tech systems have changed as well. So getting more familiar, conferences are a great way to get more information, become more familiar with operational competency kind of stuff because you can play with the toys that you're teaching someone how to use.
Right. And I will say, you know, I have gone many, many times to ATIA, which is the Assistive Technology Industry Association conference. And what is particularly great about that conference is that it is put on by the assistive technology industry. So they have a really robust vendor hall. There's a lot of access to the vendor hall. And so you really have a lot of the people there all in one space and you can go in and that is the vendor hall as opposed to some, like ASHA, the vendor hall is a bit overwhelming for me. It's so huge. There are so many people. So everybody has sort of different preferences if you prefer to go. I mean, obviously, I prefer to go very deep and narrow in one area. So that's, I guess, not surprising.
Right.
But I agree. So operational skills, we've talked a lot about operational skills in terms of the generalist SLP facilitator or partner. And the reason that that's important is because operational skills on the part of the AAC user are very essential. So in the Light and McNaughton article, they talk about how with respect to the communicator, these are the skills that they need to produce the hand or body positions, shapes, orientations, movements for gestures, signs, other modes of communication, being able to utilize different selection techniques. So are they somebody who's using direct selection? If so, what part of your body? Are they using indirect selection, some type of scanning? How do they navigate? Do they have the skills to navigate and operate aided AAC systems accurately and efficiently? Can the communicator program their system themselves? Are they able to identify vocabulary that should be added? And are they able to add those words themselves? So these are really important skills. You have to have the linguistic, the operational, and social competencies. And I think that this is a really important thing for people who are working with complex communicators who are using AAC to be aware of. You know, you need to have the linguistic skills, you need to have the operational skills, but you also have to learn the pragmatic component. You need to figure out like when and when shouldn't I and where and with whom and how do I communicate with different people in different places. You know, these are all of the things that we're working on when we're working on pragmatics. We're thinking about like, how do I enter into a communication interaction with you? How do I take turns and not talk over you? How do I maintain a topic? How do I shift a topic?
And I have always found that this is a very tricky thing to get into because the nature of AAC, you know, communication rates are much slower. Communication partners don't tend to want to wait as long. They want to finish the sentence or they want to jump into the communication exchange. So in my personal experience, this can be a very tricky, not impossible, but it takes a little bit of maybe finesse or open and honest conversation about the nature of AAC and how it is so different than natural communication. Have you had that experience also?
I think that for all of these areas, but particularly social and strategic, the next one that we'll talk about, it really includes the partner a lot. It includes the partner. Like the partner needs to take a role, an active role in being a supportive communication partner. So I think that under the social and strategic domain, we think more about things we can do to help support the communication partner. And so those may be strategies like wait silently. Don't read over the communicator's shoulder. Don't try and finish their sentence for them. And I think all of these things are also individualized. You know, the person who is the AAC user needs to be have an important, very the important voice in deciding, you know, what is appropriate for them. I think all of these things are variable based upon, you know, who you are and your, you know, your culture, your sociolinguistic skills are not a universal. In some cultures and in some circles of relationships, things are going to be appropriate and inappropriate. You know, we think about like right now I'm in my like pseudo professional mode, right? I'm like professional / podcasty, so casual professional. But you know, when I am not serving as a professional and I'm out casually with my friends, I have different ways that I would enter a conversation, right? And I code switch depending upon the environment and the people. So there's the sociolinguistic skill of understanding the pragmatic difference in those different environments and with those different relationships. They also group under social competence in the 2003 article, socio-relational skills. So this would be, you know, these are kind of pieces that also further add to somebody's pragmatic skills. So, you know, are you an active participant in interactions? Do you seem interested in your communication partner? Do you project a positive self-image? You know, these relational skills, Light makes the point in the 2003 article, Light et al., you know, that these are really important for people who might have significant barriers to their interpersonal relationships.
Super, super important. And I think SLPs in general, depending on, again, going back to those roles, I think SLPs were very aware of the need for social skills. We get a lot of training on it, but this is another way that the general practice SLP can help other people on the team overcome this barrier in terms of educating them about the social impact and the relationship between pragmatic skills and an AAC user and society and expectations and all of those kinds of things. How does that tie into the strategic component?
So the strategic component is the last of those four key competency areas that were identified by Light way back in 1989 and have been subsequently revised by her. You know, the strategic component is really being able to identify the barriers in your environment, identify the barriers in your society, identify the barriers inherent to the use of your AAC system, and then pick different strategies that helps you to bypass those limitations and make the best choice for what's going to optimize your communication in these different environments, given these different barriers. So this is a really pretty sophisticated skill that needs to be explicitly taught for a lot of people, like troubleshoot it together, troubleshoot, you know, okay, so in particular for people who have oral speech or gestures or vocalizations that are well understood by their familiar communication partners, having a frank conversation where you break down different situations that they may find themselves in and help come up with a plan, again, together about what might be some strategies they might use. Okay, so you're going to go to the coffee shop and you're going to order, you know, the usual. And maybe there's a coffee shop you go to a lot. And if this one guy, Jim, is working, he totally knows your vocalizations and gestures and he's going to get you what you want. And that's going to be the quickest and most efficient way to have that communication exchange if Jim's working. But if Jim's not working and there's somebody new, what are you going to do? Do you want to try? You know, and having it's having the critical thinking around identifying those barriers in your environment, and then how are you going to troubleshoot it based upon all the tools that you have in your toolbox?
One of the things that I love the most about the notes you have here, but also this article, is being strategic about overcoming social constraints. And you have written here about, you know, an example would be talking to someone about using humor to put a communication partner at ease, an unfamiliar communication partner. And I think having these conversations is so important And also might make people uncomfortable at first, but I think it's such a crucial component of human connection, you know, yeah. to help people who are AAC users have that human connection and use their AAC tools to establish and maintain those human connections.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. I mean, I would definitely point people to this article. If you see yourself at all in that third barrier, like, where do I start? Print this out and read through it and kind of think about different goals and objectives that might be appropriate for the person who's using AAC, who is on your caseload or in your classroom or in your family. And kind of think about, is there some skill kind of from each of these big domain areas that could be helpful? And where am I going to start? What's an appropriate starting place? And where do I take my next steps? We're not going to get into the additional psychosocial factors, but I would definitely encourage you to read the article. I think, you know, the psychosocial factors that she identified in this 2003 article and that they're talking about throughout this 2014 article are motivation, attitude, confidence, and resilience. You know, a while back there was a lot, you know, like the catchphrase was grit and like, how do we, can you teach somebody to have grit and all these things? I think what's really important and was really meaningful for me in rereading this article was that all of these things aren't related to speech and language goals, but they're related to how we interact and include other people in our lives and how, you know, we're supporting different environments for communicators. And I think just being aware in the back of your mind about, you know, is my interaction with this person promoting their motivation? You know, am I approaching them with a positive attitude? Am I helping them to have a positive attitude about their AAC system? Am I helping to build their confidence? Am I helping to build their resilience? And just being aware that, you know, these factors are not things that you get from the standard scores on the self, but they're really important. And together, all of these different components integrate to form the foundation of skills that help somebody to be a competent communicator with AAC. It's a great article. You should check it out.
We hope that everybody is feeling a little bit more secure in some of these AAC basics and underpinnings. The literature that we reviewed today is really a springboard, I think, into asking so many more questions, learning so much more. If you're still with us and you have questions, please, please, please send us an email. We want to learn more about mentorship, you want to learn more about the upcoming certification process, which we don't know very much about, but if you have any questions whatsoever, please don't hesitate to reach out. We love hearing from you. Is there anything else?
No, I think that's it.
Huzzah. We do still want someone to tell us if they have the opposite for huzzah. You have to, if anybody has any ideas, you could just send us an email that says nothing but poo-poo and I will be happy.
Oh, it should not say poo-poo.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, everyone.